From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Many of the problems in society today are simply too complex to think about easily. Take healthcare or the economy or social welfare. Besides being complex, the various proposed solutions to these problems also reflect a diversity of human values. Each of us has our own beliefs as to our personal and societal responsibilities. John Hiles is president of Thinking Tools, a Monterey, California-based company which specializes in using computer games and simulations to address complex sociological problems. I'll talk to him about their popular software package, SimCity, and their latest product, SimHealth, a national healthcare model. I'll also speak with Dwayne Donner. He's the president of the California Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and he's the author of a new book, The Healthcare Solution. We'll look at how technology has affected the healthcare crisis. Thinking Tools develops software packages which let people think about complex problems. I commented to John Hiles, the president of Thinking Tools, that when most people think about PC software, they think word processing, spreadsheets, databases, and email, but that he is looking at applications which do much more.
It sort of started with games. When you look at people at an arcade and you see all of the body action and energy that they put into the games, that energy could be put into thinking and learning if we found the right way with software. And that's one of the challenges for us, is to create simulations for serious purposes that still have some of those game properties.
Well, what are those game properties?
The first and foremost is that I've never met anyone that read a manual to start playing a game. So they want to jump in. And the way games accomplish that is with a visual interface that people can recognize. They know which end is up, and they know more or less what's going on, and then they start experimenting. So the first step is to have what I would call a recognition interface. So if you're doing a simulation about healthcare industry, you need things that look like the healthcare industry. The second step is to sort of open the door, to bring the people into the game. And you do that by allowing their decisions to shape the game so that it becomes their company or their personal healthcare reform or their city or planet. Their decisions make it personalized. And then they're ready for the third step. Once they've personalized the system through their own decisions, they want to see what happens. And so then you have to flood them with feedback. And the fourth step is something that actually takes place outside of the computer. You want the game to support people telling each other stories about what that experience meant. So the meaning, people create meaning. And stories are the containers that they use to hold this meaning. And you want the games to support those stories. If you look at young kids playing video games, trading the clues and the tactics,
oh, yeah.
That's a big deal for them. In fact, there's big circulation magazines that just exchange stories between Sega and Nintendo players.
You know, I'm really fascinated by what you say, because even though you just rattled those off, 1, 2, 3, 4, there's so much that is important here. The first is that the old days where you sat down and read the manual, nobody really wants to do that. The kids don't do it. Many of them can't read, and they're using video games.
Right.
So it has to be some kind of self-involvement where you don't sit there and have to go through first to do this. And then
that's right. A long, slow startup time is not going to work. And if you look back in the history of mainframe computer software, you see people who have tried to deliver decision support software to business executives, and they say, well, now you have to go to a class and learn how to use it. And by and large, that decision support software doesn't get used for that reason.
Then you move along, and I've always been trying to figure out what's so compelling about video games. The idea that this is your city or your health or your whatever it is.
Right.
The moment that is, there's this emotional connection to how you shape it and what's going to happen to it.
Yes.
And that responsiveness, I mean, that alone would do it. Now, originally, Thinking Tools was part of Maxis, which popularized SimCity. Can you tell us about SimCity and Maxis and how everything evolved into Thinking Tools?
Yes. In about 1987, a very bright programmer named Will Wright was interested in building a game where you could bomb islands or cities, and it was going to be a pretty
standard video game.
and he decided to build an editor that would allow you to lay out the cities and islands first before blowing them up. And he looked at that and decided that that was much more fun than the bombing part of the game. So he just expanded it, and out of that came SimCity. SimCity has probably been played by more than 10 million people. We know that they're in excess of 2 million copies sold. And it has established this type of simulation game where instead of a steady stream of space bugs or something that you shoot at and that where the game is a reflexive game, this is more of a decision-making and planning type of style, and it's just right for the type of simulations that we build in Thinking Tools. Thinking Tools was formed at the beginning of this year. Prior to that time, we were Maxis Business Simulations, a subsidiary of Maxis, and we were focused on the question of, could you transfer these four properties that I mentioned before to serious simulations for business and government? And we found that we could. And we decided to spin Maxis Business Simulations off, and it became a separate company called Thinking Tools.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is John Hiles. He's president of Thinking Tools, a company which applies computer game technology to real-life societal problems. Let's just stick for a second here with SimCity. The idea is that you identify, you know, houses and hospitals and I don't know what else. What are you looking for in SimCity? What do you learn?
Well, my reading on the way the game, why the game is so satisfying, and we have seen marketing studies and focus groups that show there are people that spend hundreds of hours making their own cities. And I've tried to figure out what's so compelling and captivating about SimCity, and I think that the key is that you make decisions, and there's a variety of context information that you can tap. The game doesn't preach at you. The information's there. It's more or less invisible, but when you want it, you can bring it up, and it can inform your decisions. Then you have to make a choice, and you lay out in SimCity, you lay out the zoning for a city. You can also lay out the roads and highways and tracks and power lines. After you do that, the simulation starts to do things on its own. So one of the requirements for a game that comes on one or two discs and yet can keep people busy for hundreds of hours is that the game needs to sort of surf off of the choices and information that the player brings to it. If the player comes up with new ideas, then the game reacts to those ideas in new ways, and it's continually surprising. So the game doesn't saturate. If you think of some games that you've played where after you figure out the secret, or after somebody tells you the secret, and then you kind of put it away, that game doesn't have the ability that SimCity has. The reason why SimCity can do that, and then simulations that are like it, is that it is able to adapt to the player's choices. There are things in the game, inside that box, that can adapt to what you're doing at the keyboard.
So if you're going along and you suddenly realize you don't have enough schools, I don't know if that's an appropriate question,
right,
then at that point you can stop it. You can say, let's build a school here, let's build a school here, let's
yes.
build a school here.
Yeah, for example, in the old SimCity, if your crime rate was going up and citizens were moving out of your city because of high crime, you might need to build up enough resources to build more police stations. Or if the city was burning down, you might need to try to bring in firemen. The mayor or the player can make those decisions, but then the game responds in a non-predictable way. The game responds to your choices.
Now, you've gone from SimCity. Now you're in SimHealth.
Right.
Tell us about that.
In December of 1992, the Markle Foundation came to us at Maxis Business Simulations and asked if we thought we could build one of these simulation games to present a public policy topic. And the public policy topic that they thought would be just the right timing was healthcare. They wanted to know if we could show the reform issues, the problems in the U.S. healthcare system that had to do with coverage and cost and decisions or autonomy of patients and doctors. And that's what the subject of SimHealth is. You play the role of reformer, a policymaker, who comes into office with a constituency that more or less agrees with the values that you bring to the game. The way the game works is that you always do get elected, but before you can get elected, you have to explain your values. And then you have the opportunity to put together a healthcare system based on those values. So you're the decision maker, and you have very much the same policy possibilities and elements that Congress is looking at today to reshape the healthcare system in the United States.
Give us an example of those. I mean, hospitals?
Yes. For example, universal care is a universal coverage of health insurance is a key part of President Clinton's proposal. There are several ways to deliver and pay for universal care. You can support it from the federal government through taxes, general taxes. You can have an employer mandate, or you can put the mandate on the public and require that the citizens pay for it. Or you can decide to operate without a universal coverage in your reform. Those are choices that you have, and the choices can be put into effect right away, all at once, or incrementally. And the game does provide this continuous feedback. You're looking at a metaphorical city where the buildings represent the different institutions of our society that are involved in healthcare. So there's hospitals and physicians' offices, insurance building, a government building, big business and small business. And your decisions can either wreck those institutions or leave them alone as you go towards your goals for healthcare.
Okay, now let's take an example. Let's say that I say, well, we're not going to spend any more money on paramedics. We're just going to have a real basic kind of service. What will it show me if I don't have enough paramedics?
Well, if you cut down on the supply of emergency health care, for example, you'll find that the appearance of the hospital or the physician's offices begin to change because of long waiting times or a loss of autonomy or simply not enough people to take care of the demands. So, for instance, you could put a cap on physician salaries as a measure to hold down costs. But if you do that, the game will come back and show that instead of working 60 and 70-hour weeks, now the doctors are not willing to do that. They're cutting back. And so the supply of primary or specialist health care is going down. Longer waiting lines, and then ripple effects, side effects in other parts of the medical system.
You might realize then you have to look for more doctors.
Yeah, that's right. Or and there are other ways to approach that. One of the great things about these complicated systems, when you put them into a simulation, is that it is possible to show people who are not experts in the system how one move in one place can create little wiggles and surprises in other places. And we're surrounded with these systems in our life, and that's one of the things that comes through so clearly with Sim Health. It's clearly a complicated and adaptive system, so that if you try to wade into it from the front and just make the changes in a straightforward way, you'll get surprises from the side.
You know, that is interesting. There's an old cartoon that used to have years and years and years ago. It used to have something called the Shmoo. And you'd poke one side and it would pop out another. And whenever I look at these really complex problems, I always think of the Shmoo. It's like, who can consider it all? Who can think of it all?
Well, the examples, when I talk about these, I use a jargon. I call them complex adaptive systems. And people immediately want to know what are some examples of those. And the greatest example I can think of is that every time Congress tries to rewrite the tax law, the tax attorneys respond almost immediately with a whole bunch of clever ways to get around the new law. And that's an example of the pieces of the system are the attorneys and the legislators and the legislation. But there's adapting. The attorneys are adapting almost immediately to the new changes. And you have a complex adaptive system. And it's just like the example that if you push one place, it comes out the other.
My guest today is John Hiles, president of Thinking Tools and a technology pioneer. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Well, you're writing simulations, and we were just talking about this. Politicians, and all people for that matter, often disagree about the consequences of any action because they're very complex. They say, one guy says, hey, if we do this, you know, there'll be crime on the street. And the other guy says, if we do this, it'll clean it up. And you're thinking, what am I hearing? They're not differing in what they're saying so much as what the results will be. In a simulation, how can you be sure there's no bias? How do you decide what the consequences are?
Well, this is really an important problem if you try to bring simulation into public policy. In traditional simulations where you're modeling the air going over an airplane wing or something, you put physics into the model and you try to stay away from any controversy. With a simulation like SimHealth or some of the others that we're doing, you try to embed the controversy and let the player decide between the possibilities. The way that the simulation can succeed and not be turned into a propaganda machine where we stick some right answer into the code is to make the assumptions visible and accessible to the player. So there's a little menu item called Assumptions in SimHealth, and when you click on it, you get a list of the models that we use for healthcare economics. There's 8 of them. And so, for instance, if you were interested in our assumptions about the relationship between preventive medicine and inpatient demand in hospitals, you could pull that assumption out. And we give you 2 assumptions in the game. One is a friendly one that is easy to play against, and the other one's a critical one that is tough. And you may decide that you want to work against a third assumption. You can put that assumption in. And then once you push the do it button, then that assumption goes into effect for your simulation. One thing about these assumptions that I think is very important, we ran into this quite early in designing SimHealth, and I think it's true of any attempt to simulate a public policy issue. A fellow actually explained this to a group of politicians that had invited him to speak. His name was Uwe Reinhardt, who's a leading healthcare economist from Princeton. And Uwe was talking to the group and said, you have to realize that when you ask people to make predictions about what will happen with these different reforms, you're getting ideology and not science. That depending on which person, which expert you pull in, you'll get an explanation that is what you want to hear or different. And that's because we don't know. And in simulating this, we also don't know what's going to turn out. So we try to bring the areas of controversy into the game and let the player decide between them. I think that's very important because it means that non-specialists, non-experts like myself and audience for this game, can become familiar with the areas that are very relevant to healthcare, but they're areas where we don't know what's going to happen. And we can begin to explore, well, what might happen if this were really awful or what might happen if we lucked out and things worked out just well.
Many people don't realize when you're talking about these complicated models and complicated systems is that that first step of, oh, you know, we make that assumption, it's just getting so complicated. Quite often, you have to kind of stand back and say, well, if you're right, if you think if we do this, you know, how many times people have sat around the kitchen table and said, well, if we do this, this will happen and that'll be awful,
yeah,
or that'll be terrific. And that's actually great. So, okay, great. Well, here's your chance. Do that. And sure enough, what you predicted was right. That was terrific. But what you didn't see were four other bad things that happened and two really good things that you didn't think was related. So it's not that you have to understand the entire simulation, but you have to understand a more global view to the effects of what you're seeing.
Exactly. That's the reason why I think it's fair to call these new little baby things. They're just developing. They're going to improve considerably as we learn more about this. But I think that what we're seeing are the beginning of some thinking tools. These are tools that really do hold your places, help you examine some of the less likely possibilities. These systems that we're surrounded with in our culture are truly complicated. And in many cases, the people that manage them don't even have a full picture of how they work. They have a perspective or they have several perspectives, but in some cases, the systems may involve thousands of perspectives. And the computer can come into contact with our culture at these complicated systems and hold places and give us a number of shelves where we can put some of these possibilities out in view and come back to them, refer back to them. So I think that is precisely the job of this kind of software, to support us, to help us to think about some of these complicated systems that are really quite overwhelming if we don't have some help from somewhere.
When I think about complicated data, it can even be simple data, but it can actually come out really in a complicated form. So I can't see anything. Forest, trees, bushes, sky.
Mm-hmm.
It mm-hmm. looks like a jungle to me. It's very important that you're able to see, and sort of in quotes, see what you're looking at. And it almost seems to me that these thinking tools couldn't be brought about except without the graphical interface that you see. That's an essential part to these models.
Yes, it is. Not just because of the idea of people not reading manuals and not being willing to spend a lot of time learning software. That's true. But even once the person has learned the software, I guess that I'll back up one step and say that as great a mind as Albert Einstein made the statement one time that if I can't see it, I can't understand it. And that's really true when you come to these complicated adaptive systems. I'll use the word aggregate. So much of what we talk about and the problems that we are worried about in modern life are aggregate problems. If you think of the 1992 presidential election and people driving around with cameras looking at the cities, where was the recession? Was it a single street corner? Was it a particular factory that was with the gate chained? That particular economic problem was very subtle to see if you looked from individual perspectives. But when you aggregated it, when you put it all together, there's a very clear-cut problem. So much of what we are facing today doesn't reveal itself to us from a single perspective. Crime does not reveal it to when you walk down the street, you don't see the crime problem. You might see someone running away from the police chasing somebody or something, but you don't see the crime problem because it's an aggregate result of many thousands of perspectives. And computers can put together synthetic displays. When you look at some of the satellite photos or the photos that NASA brought back from the planets, those photos had artificial colors to bring out contrast, and satellite photos are especially manipulated to reveal information that otherwise would be too subtle to see. Computers can produce synthetic views. They can also produce these synthetic views for aggregate problems, aggregate systems. And then, when they do that, they give us the ability to summarize lots and lots of perspectives, many people's perspectives, and to give someone who otherwise would never have a chance to see the aggregate system, give them a chance to see it in one view. And it's at that point that they begin to understand what they're up against.
It's one thing to say, let's encourage clear thinking, logic, as if there's a right way, to think, and that type of thing. Everyone who arrives at one of these games is bringing into it their own values. How do you honor their values, allow their values to come into it, versus sort of influencing their thinking from the simulation?
Right. The question of a person's values was one of the places in the Sim Health project that we had the most fun. We tried to create a screen in the game called the Value Screen, and it has a picture of the Jefferson Memorial, where we would find out what the values of the player were. So we presented different questions that sort of outline the shape of our current healthcare problems. There's millions of people that don't have healthcare coverage. They're mostly working poor. There are tremendous costs associated with healthcare, and the costs are growing. Right now, we're spending more for healthcare in this country than we spend for education and defense combined. There's a collision between attempts to control costs and the traditional autonomy that patients and doctors have in the country. So we present problems like that, and then we offer opinionated solutions, like healthcare is a matter of individual responsibility, or healthcare is a universal right. Those two suggestions represent two values. And as in life, often the values are in conflict. In this case, the first value is liberty. And the second one, universal healthcare, that's equality. You can describe the conflict between these two values by saying total liberty for the wolves is death to the lambs. And on the other hand, if you have a workers' paradise where everyone is equal, there's no liberty. So we show the conflicting values and let the player select the right mix according to their own feelings. So we try to bring values which are usually held in close. A person sort of protects their values from the outside world. In the game, we encourage them to bring those values out into the game. And then once we have them, up to that point, we're agnostic towards the player's values. We don't favor one value over the other. But once we do have them, then we hold the player to those values. And for instance, in Sim Health, if they build a healthcare system consistent with their values, they continue to get political capital so that they can do more and stay in office. If they go against their values, then their constituency turns on them, and they lose political capital, and within the next 2 years or the next election, they'll get thrown out, and that'll be the end of the game.
That sort of reinforces democracy.
Yes.
Okay, how many times have people asked you, does Hillary Clinton know about this program?
Well, she certainly knows about the program. I was invited to the White House between November and late January to install Sim Health on different computers and to present it to different groups. And although I didn't present it directly to Mrs. Clinton, the people on the healthcare task force certainly had a good look at it, and I'm sure that they're aware of it.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
My guest today has been John Hiles. He is president of Thinking Tools, a Monterey, California-based company which specializes in using computer game simulations to address complex sociological problems. Their latest product is Sim Health, a national healthcare model. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Since World War II, there has been and continues to be an explosion of medical technology in this country. If everything else stayed the same, that single fact alone adds to the healthcare situation like a runaway train. I asked Dwayne Donner, the president of the California Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, to comment on that.
Contrary to the development of technology in many other areas, it reduces cost. In healthcare, adding new technology normally layers on additional utilization, additional diagnostic work, and new therapies. And the combination of all of those means that about a third of the increase is due to technology. There are many technologies available today in healthcare which were not even in existence 10 years ago. And many of those either save infants that are premature or they extend life. And in either case, the cost is very high.
Tip O'Neill always said, all politics is local. And he wrote in the foreword to your book that it occurred to him that all medical care is local as well. Since medical care is delivered locally and local circumstances vary dramatically, can we really have a workable national health care plan?
I don't believe there is one template that will apply nationwide. For example, in California, more than three-fourths of the population already is enrolled in managed care. In states like Alabama, Mississippi, and Wyoming, less than 2% of the population is enrolled in managed care plans. In California, more than 12 million people are enrolled directly in HMOs, or health maintenance organizations, whereas in some of those other states, less than one-half of 1% are in an HMO. It just doesn't make sense that we're going to impose one nationwide model in the next year or two or five, considering the vast differences socioeconomically, demographically, and in the way health insurance and health delivery has played out over the last four or five decades.
Health insurance is a relatively new phenomenon.
Post-World War II, primarily.
So what did people do before?
Well, health care was not a high-tech service prior to World War II. X-rays were discovered in 1898 and then were rudimentary until after World War II. Sulfa drugs were created at the turn of the century, and penicillin wasn't around until around World War II. So if you stop and look back at what was available, it was minimal. And then after World War II, the Hill-Burton Act was created. It produced an impetus for hospitals. Medical school education changed, and the explosion in technology and knowledge began. And in fact, today, every 10 years, we learn as much as we had in the previous history of the country in healthcare. So computerization, new technology, the ways in which we apply telecommunications, other kinds of technology, much of which has been developed in the space industry, in the military, and in other fields that have nothing to do with healthcare. But the bottom line to that is we have more and more available, and it does things which we just could not conceive in the past. And if you just project out for the next 5 years, we know that the telecommunications industry, for example, is going to bring online direct eye-to-eye contact at a relatively low cost. Now, when that happens, it is likely that we'll start seeing diagnosis in the home. We will even see direct patient care delivered to people in their home because they'll be able to see the practitioner and have it explained to them in a way that is much different than today.
So, show me your wound.
Right. And the physician will look at it and make a diagnosis and give instructions, be able to demonstrate what to do. Especially that is true for the elderly people when someone's in the home to care for them. Now, it becomes much more difficult when there's only one elderly person or two and they have difficulty comprehending. But there will be automatic triggers for people when they need to take medications. Older people many times forget medications, and there will be automatic phone calls, a communicator that comes on the screen and says, be sure and take your medication. All of those things will reduce the consumption of health care in the more expensive settings, like in the hospital.
I have to say, I was pretty excited about here I actually have somebody like you right in front of me. And I thought, okay, now it's time to ask my big question. People, I'm sure, corner you and say, okay, here we go. I was listening to Car Talk over the weekend, and Tom and Ray were going on about, oh, gee, the garage next door, the body shop. These guys have pictures of them standing on their boat, you know, holding up fish. And they say, we always go over there and tell them, get those pictures down. You know, these people don't want to know. They're paying for your boat, you know. Now, look, there's something visceral about health costs. Now, I remember the last time I had a baby was 9 years ago, and I went in the hospital, and I got my bill, and they had a package of 12 sanitary napkins for $26 right there on my bill. Now, I know how much sanitary napkins cost, and I'm thinking, could you have charged me $5 and taken the other $21 and put it on something I had no idea? You know, how do these things come about?
That's like the $5 aspirin.
Yeah.
Well, frankly, the charging practices of hospitals have emanated over the years because of Medicare. When Medicare started in 1965, it created a chart of accounts for hospitals and then started paying hospitals on the basis of cost. And that changed up until 1982 when the Medicare DRG system went in. And now Medicare pays hospitals on the basis of the case. And it doesn't matter whether the patient stays in 2 days or 12 days, the Medicare payment is the same. Medicaid programs in most states, and certainly in California, pays far less than Medicare, about 69% of the actual cost. So it doesn't matter, again, what the hospital charges, Medicaid pays a set amount. They become essentially a rate-setting body for themselves. What happens to the shortfall? The hospitals have to charge the private patients. Those of us that have insurance pay not only for our care, we're paying for the shortfall that Medicare and Medicaid create. In addition, we now have about 38 million people in this country without health insurance on an average day. Many of those people, in fact, the far majority of them, come in and have no money. And so they become charity care and bad debts. And the paying patients end up subsidizing their care as well. What it amounts to is you and I, with insurance, pay about 130% of the cost of our own care, so that money that the hospital collects goes to cover the shortfall from Medicare and Medicaid and the underinsured or uninsured people who are charity patients. So we are, in effect, being taxed through our health insurance for those people who don't have insurance, and secondly, for the underpayments by the government.
Okay, and you're saying that's another 130% or
no,
another 30%?
No, it's an additional 30% over above our own. If
okay,
everybody
so
paid...
I hate to tell you this, but we're down to an $18 box of sanitary napkins.
Yeah.
Okay, now you got about 13 bucks on me here.
All right, the way that works, the hospitals have revenue-producing departments and they have non-revenue-producing departments. And hospitals, in many cases, have departments that actually lose money. Emergency department, the obstetrical department, certain kinds of high-tech services, they lose money. On the other hand, there are certain areas where they make charges: pharmacy, lab, radiology, central supply. That's where the sanitary napkins come from, in the central supply. And they have a high markup in those areas because that's where they generate the revenue to cover for the other aspects of the hospital that where they don't charge, and then secondly, to cover the losses I described earlier. So really what you're doing is you're taking the entire spectrum of hospital services and you're establishing charges for a portion of those services that are rendered, and they show up on the bill and they look very high on a line item basis. The only way to really compare hospital costs among hospitals in a community or in other communities or in other countries is to look at the per diem, or the total amount of hospital expenses on average for the population. Then you get a real reasonable comparison. Otherwise, you're looking at a one leg of the elephant, and you can't see the entire animal, and so you get a distorted view.
Well, but if I heard you correctly, it sounds like, okay, we got these total costs. We know we can charge them here, we can charge them there. That's how we're going to do it. I think, just from my point of view, if you can come in with a $5, $7 box of sanitary napkins for me, then if all politics and then all medical care is local, that's what I understand. Mm-hmm. So that if you could spread it around, you might have a little better PR.
I agree. I think that's a great point. And in fact, what we should get to under health reform with a standard benefit package and everybody covered is a set of charges that would be more global. And so it's going to cost you so much per day or so much per case. Everybody's going to pay it, and you won't have the uninsured, and you won't have government underpaying. And then it becomes much more comparable. And you don't have to worry about those little individual line items where the charge is substantially higher than the cost of that item.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Duane Donner. He's the president and CEO of the California Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, representing over 500 hospitals and health systems in California. Everyone knows that the Clinton administration is proposing a national health care plan, and very few people really understand it. I mean, I can tell that from letters to the editor and talking to people. You've proposed an approach to national health care. Where do you see the government playing a good role, and where should it simply not be?
Well, as Tip O'Neill said in the foreword, not only are politics a local matter, but also health care is. People receive health services in their local community, and most people's doctor and hospital are within 8 miles of their home. So you can see people don't look to the federal government for their health care. Now, since World War II, and particularly since 1962, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of employers that provide coverage for the employees, and it becomes a fringe benefit, so it becomes more accepted. Well, as technology has increased and life has been extended, the cost is more. And now we are somewhat insensitive to the cost because the employer pays a big part of the premium. Now, how do we deal with it? How do we get back into the groove where everyone is covered and everyone is following good habits? You don't rely on government to do it because government can't control personal behavior. The best way for us to modify our behavior is with incentives that mean something to us, where we're accountable for our own actions. I have suggested that the best way to do that is to put in governmental policies which are congruent with incentives and changing our own behavior. For example, a high tax on tobacco and alcohol products is appropriate because we know they're detrimental to health when they're abused, and in fact, when tobacco is used, it's detrimental to health. Secondly, there are other products, food products, which are known to be detrimental. We should have a tax on those. So people that choose to utilize those products will pay for it, and it will go into a fund to help underwrite costs because their health care costs are going to be more because of their behavior. There are other things that you can deal with that won't generate much money, like bullets and guns. And while violence is a major problem, we're not going to gain a lot by taxing those, although I do agree with the principle of taxing them. Now, I get down to the specific plan. The president originally proposed a plan which was built around what we call managed competition. That is, creating choice for individuals where they could select a plan, whether it was fee-for-service or a preferred provider arrangement of some kind, or even an HMO, a full prepaid capitated plan. What he failed to do was understand that you can't overregulate it and then try to protect everybody from reform. If we are going to reform the healthcare system, it must affect every one of us, whether we're a consumer, a payer, the government, or a provider of healthcare services. And if you leave anybody out or start carving any subcomponent out, then we fail to achieve the results. Government can't regulate our behavior and can't regulate us. When they try it, it creates a mentality of how do I get around and through and over and under the regulations. And that's what will happen. That's what's happened in other countries where they've had a top-down regulatory approach to government controls. And in fact, in Canada last year, their health care cost increase were higher than ours. So that's not really the solution. We have to step back and say, what do we do to generate aligned incentives so that all people in the healthcare equation have a common goal and they have common interests? And I believe the way to do that is to provide universal coverage to a uniform benefit package, which is standard for everyone. You have portability among employers. Employers pay the predominant proportion of the premium, and individuals pay a portion, but they also pay when they use services. That's commonly called a copayment at the time services are utilized. And there's ample evidence to show that if we have an economic role to play when we demand health care, it affects the way we demand it and how we use it. We are more judicious in our decisions, like we are in everything else.
Well, I didn't pay a nickel on the $26 box of sanitary napkins, so I really didn't go down and pound my fist on the counter.
Right.
Because at that point, my deductible was history. I mean, we're gone.
Right. And deductibles are not as important as copays. Deductibles are an upfront amount you pay, and then once you've paid that amount, it's all over and you're home free. Everything else is covered. If you have a copayment that goes on for a while, then you're paying a percentage of the bill. And if everybody is covered and we have a standard benefit package that's portable, then you don't worry about those high charges, you know, in certain areas, because those are a thing of the past. And then you're now looking at the overall choices you've made, and you've made those in advance, and then you know what you're going to pay when you go for the services that you receive. This means that providers will form in networks and compete with others. And as an example, in Sacramento, there are three systems emerging: Kaiser, which has been around, of course, for a long time, Sutter Health, and Mercy Healthcare. In San Diego, California, you have the Kaiser system, the Scripps system, and Sharp Healthcare. And these are going to compete with one another, and people will have choices. And in some of those choices, there will be fee-for-service plans, as well as the preferred provider arrangements, all the way up to the capitated or bundled payment arrangements, which normally would require less out-of-pocket by the individuals. I believe people are well enough educated that if they are given good choices and they're not manipulated, that we will perform better on all sides of the healthcare equation. Government cannot do that. We have to do that ourselves.
So you're saying that if I have a choice and there is a downside to this plan versus that plan, I'm certainly going to take the one that gives me the appropriate services, but I'm going to take the one that costs me the least, and that's going to keep the cost down.
You are going to be cost sensitive. You may not choose the one that costs the least, because when you get to the one that may cost you the least, it may also have insufficient choice from your point of view. And if you choose to spend discretionary income to have greater choice and do things that others might not choose to do, you can have that latitude. See, that's the beauty of having these choices.
My guest today is Duane Donner. He is a member of the American Hospital Association Board of Trustees and author of the book, The Healthcare Solution. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I was fascinated in your book. It was saying that General Motors is the largest employer payer of health care in the nation, and that General Motors pays $5 per hour per employee, which translates into $1,400 per car produced. And there are several factors here. First of all, General Motors is paying $800 per month in health benefits for employee, and then why can the Japanese pay only $500 per car produced? And we're paying $1,400.
There are four or five reasons why employers like General Motors have a higher than average health care bill today. First is their benefit package is extremely liberal, and it is all paid by the employer. The employee pays virtually nothing. But over the years, some of those companies, including General Motors, funded their health care costs of the future for retirees, like we fund Social Security as a nation. That is, on a cash basis. And we didn't fund Social Security on an accrual basis. So we end up paying as we go. The same thing happened in General Motors. They did not fund the future health care bill for which they're obligated for retirees, especially early retirees before they hit age 65 and can qualify for Medicare. And not only are the employees essentially paying for their own health care costs and allocations from the General Motors, but there's also an allocation for the retirees. And that is one reason why it is very expensive. I think if you summarize it, you could say when the employer pays all the tab, you're going to have undisciplined access, higher utilization, and greater costs. And that's not cost effective.
But if I look at this $5 per hour per employee, what that breaks down to is some percentage of that is paying for their retired employees for which they did not plan. So in their business plan, they are carrying the cost of funding the current retirees. And that's acceptable. That says that $800 per month per family is actually higher than you would need in health cost.
That's correct.
So it could really be more around $500.
It may be $500 or $600. And depending on where they live, obviously the costs in Detroit are higher than they are in plants that may be in the South. And you have to look at a wide variety of factors. But we have made some bad decisions in the past about providing coverage, paying for coverage, and holding individuals harmless.
But Duane, let me say this to you. You're saying, would that price be down in total? That's the price. The price is $500 a month per family. That's the price. Doesn't matter who pays it. Unless you're saying, if it's just to say that, well, because the company's paying it, it's $500 a month. If that's the price, that's the price. Are you saying that if we can have a different health care system, that price might go down to $400, $300?
Yes. It won't go down that low, but if we have choices and generate our own pressure on the system for accountability and cost consciousness, there will be a lower rate of increase in health care costs. And people will choose some plans which are lower than the $600 or $700 plan. They may choose one that's $500. And the more people that migrate towards those lower cost plans, the greater the pressure on the high cost plans.
Right. Okay. So but that's a really good point here, is that people have to expect that somehow, somewhere between $350 and $450 a month in today's world is what's going to take to really pay medical coverage for your family and get the services you need, regardless of the plan.
I think that's accurate. I think that the data shows that you can't have a free lunch, and health care costs are high. But you get a lot for it today compared to what we did in the past, and we just have to accept that as we do the cost of police protection, fire protection, and other things that we believe are essential for us to have a free society that is healthy.
100 years ago, there wasn't room in a budget for car payments and car insurance. Okay, you got to understand. Now we have a lot more medical services, and they have to be paid for somehow. Somebody's got to do it. So the issue is that we've got a lot of retirees, a lot of senior citizens. We've got a lot more technology that can be brought in the first year of life. And as a society, that has all to be paid for. Either the insurance companies can go and only insure people from the age of 15 to 40 and then get out, and then the rest of the system has to handle the rest of them. What are we talking about? How do we get everybody to pay?
Well, in those predatory practices you just described, many insurance companies are guilty. And laws are being passed in states like California and others to prohibit those types of cherry-picking activities. The president's proposal, as well as most other health reform plans in the Congress, would also eliminate nationwide those types of activities which do not serve the public interest. And the companies who are cherry-picking are going to go out of business because they won't be able to do that anymore.
So the laws will that's another place the government is good at, preventing those kind of business practices.
Preventing abuse and fraud, and creating the right kinds of incentives. That's what government should do to protect the public interest. And we believe that that can be done. In fact, it has been done in a number of states.
Well, you quote George Gallup of Gallup Polls, and he says, the public is ready to make the hard choices in health care that their elected officials are not. So the next election ought to be pretty interesting, huh?
Health care will play a greater and greater role in elections. And if the president is unsuccessful in getting something passed by 1996, it is likely that that will come back to haunt him because of the promises he's made and how far out front he is on health care reform.
Dwayne, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
My guest today has been Dwayne Donner. He is the president and CEO of the California Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and author of The Healthcare Solution, published by Vision Publishing. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Evan's perspective today is called Degrees of Freedom.
We find ourselves visiting New York at the same time, so we decide to visit the Metropolitan Museum of Art together. The museum is located in Central Park at the junction of 5th Avenue and 82nd Street, so we agree to meet at the corner. I take the bus up 5th Avenue and get off at 82nd, while you stroll across from the other side of the park. Notice that my method of getting there has only one degree of freedom, limited to the straight line the bus takes on its north-south route up Fifth Avenue, while you have 2 degrees of freedom. You are free to roam around in the park in both north-south and east-west directions. It's a fine day and you've got lots of time, so you head northeast for a while, then south and southwest, perhaps going round in a loop before making your rendezvous with me. For some reason, I'm insanely jealous of the fact that you had 2 degrees of freedom while I only had one. So I get you to agree to meet with me at the same place on the following day. You again stroll through the park, but this time I rent a helicopter and fly all around, north, south, east, west, up, down, before landing at the intersection. As I'm being arrested for hazardous flying, I smile at you and point out that while you only used 2 degrees of freedom to get there, I used 3. The rubberneckers shake their heads sadly. The fable serves to illustrate a point. Although we are indisputably three-dimensional beings living in a 3D world, we are essentially limited in our day-to-day existence to 2 dimensions. The vast majority of our lives, we are confined to within a few feet of the surface of our planet. Normally, our position here is completely defined by 2 numbers, latitude and longitude. Rarely is it necessary to add a 3rd number, altitude, since our altitude is generally within a short distance of Earth's natural elevation at that point on the surface. Like ants on the skin of a balloon, we have little choice about that 3rd dimension. We're stuck to the surface. It takes a special effort to travel into the 3rd dimension. We can move up in a Ferris wheel or fly a plane or ride a hot air balloon. We can move down by crawling into a cave or going down a mine shaft, but other than such heroic and temporary efforts, our species is limited to living in a virtually 2-dimensional world. I envy creatures of the air and of the oceans, for they fly and swim in a 3-dimensional ecstasy above the surface of our planet. Remember, the ocean bottom is also Earth's surface. To gaze on a red-tailed hawk whirling above ocean cliffs, or snorkel around multicolored tropical fish off Hawaii, is to vicariously share in their 3D worlds. No wonder hang gliding and scuba diving are such popular sports. They allow us to partake, albeit briefly, in the full dimensionality to which we were born.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.